You said...
She died 9 years later, without discovering the truth. All India Radio. Reality is a question of perspective. The further you get from the past, the more concrete and plausible it seems. But as you approach the present, it inevitably seems more and more incredible. Suppose yourself in a large cinema, sitting at first in the back row, and gradually moving up row by row until your nose is almost pressed against the screen. Gradually, the stars' faces dissolve into dancing grain. Tiny details assume grotesque proportions. The illusion dissolves, or rather, it becomes clear that the illusion itself is reality. We have come from 1915 to 1956, so we're a good deal closer to the screen. Abandoning my metaphor, then, I reiterate, entirely without a sense of shame, my unbelievable claim. After a curious accident in a washing chest, I became a sort of radio. But today, I feel confused. Padma has not returned. Should I alert the police? Is she a missing person? And in her absence, my certainties are falling apart. Even my nose has been playing tricks on me. By day, as I stroll between the pickle vats, tended by our army of strong, hairy-armed, formidably competent women, I have found myself failing to distinguish lemon odours from lime. The workforce giggles behind its hands. The poor Saab has been crossed in what? Surely not love? Padma. And the cracks spreading all over me, radiating like a spider's web from my navel. And the heat. A little confusion is surely permissible in these circumstances. Rereading my work, I have discovered an error in chronology. The assassination of Mahatma Gandhi occurs in these pages on the wrong date. But I cannot say now what the actual sequence of events might have been. In my India, Gandhi will continue to die at the wrong time. Does one error invalidate the entire fabric? Am I so far gone in my desperate need for meaning that I'm prepared to distort everything to rewrite the whole history of my times purely in order to place myself in a central role? Today, in my confusion, I can't judge. I'll have to leave it to others. For me, there can be no going back. I must finish what I've started, even if, inevitably, what I finish turns out not to be what I began. Ye akaskavani hai. This is All India Radio. Having gone out into the boiling streets for a quick meal at a nearby Irani cafe, I have returned to sit in my nocturnal pool of Anglepoise light, with only a cheap transistor for company. A hot night, bubbling air filled with the lingering scents of the silenced pickle vats, voices in the dark, pickle fumes, heavily oppressive in the heat, stimulate the juices of memory, accentuating similarities and differences between now and then. It was hot then. It is unseasonably hot now. Then, as now, someone was awake in the dark, hearing disembodied tongues. Then, as now, the one deafened ear, and fear thriving in the heat. It was not the voices, then or now, which were frightening. He, young Salim then, was afraid of an idea. The idea that his parents' outrage might lead to a withdrawal of their love, that even if they began to believe him, they would see his gift as a kind of shameful deformity. While I, now, Padmalas, send these words into the darkness, and am afraid of being disbelieved. He and I and he, I no longer have his gift. He never had mine. There are times when he seems... a stranger, almost. He had no cracks, no spider's web spread through him in the heat. Padma would believe me. But there is no Padma. Then, as now, there is hunger. But of a different kind. Not now, the then hunger of being denied my dinner, but that of having lost my cook. And another more obvious difference. Then the voices did not arrive through the oscillating valves of a transistor, which will never cease in our part of the world to symbolize impotence. Ever since the notorious free transistor sterilization bribe, the squawking machine has represented what men could do before scissors snipped and knots were tied. Then the nearly 9-year-old in his midnight bed had no need of machines. Different and similar, we are joined by heat. A shimmering heat haze then and now blurs his then time into mine. My confusion, travelling across the heat waves, is also his. What grows best in the heat? Cane sugar, the coconut palm, certain millets, such as bajra, ragi, and jawa, linseed, and, given water, tea and rice. Our hot land is also the world's second largest producer of cotton. At least it was when I learned geography under the mad eye of Mr. Emil Zagallo and the steelier gaze of a framed Spanish conquistador. But the tropical summer grows stranger fruit as well. The exotic flowers of the imagination blossom to fill the close perspiring nights with odours as heavy as musk, which give men dark dreams of discontent. Then, as now, unease was in the air. Language marches demanded the partition of the state of Bombay along linguistic boundaries. The dream of Maharashtra was at the head of some processions. The mirage of Gujarat led the others forward. Heat, gnawing at the mind's divisions between fantasy and reality, made anything seem possible. The half-waking chaos of afternoon siestas fogged men's brains, and the air was filled with the stickiness of aroused desires. What grows best in the heat? Fantasy, unreason, lust. In 1956, then, languages marched militantly through the daytime streets. By night, they rioted in my head. We shall be watching your life with the closest attention. It will be, in a sense, the mirror of our own. It's time to talk about the voices. But if only our Padma were here. I was wrong about the archangels, of course. My father's hand walloping my ear in conscious, unintentional imitation of another bodiless hand which once hit him full in the face at least had one salutary effect. It obliged me to reconsider and finally to abandon my original prophet-aping position. In bed that very night of my disgrace, I withdrew deep inside myself, despite the brass monkey who filled our blue room with her pesterings. But what did you do it for, Salim? You who were always too good and all, until she fell into dissatisfied sleep with her mouth still working silently, and I was alone with the echoes of my father's violence, which buzzed in my left ear, which whispered, "Neither Michael nor Anail, not Gabriel, forget Cassiel, Satchiel, and Samael. Archangels no longer speak to mortals. The recitation was completed in Arabia long ago. The last prophet will come only to announce the end." That night, understanding that the voices in my head far outnumbered the ranks of the angels, I decided, not without relief, that I had not, after all, been chosen to preside over the end of the world. My voices, far from being scared, turned out to be as profane and as multitudinous as dust. Telepathy, then. The kind of thing you're always reading about in the sensational magazines. But I ask for patience. Wait, only wait. It was telepathy, but also more than telepathy. Don't write me off too easily. Telepathy, then. The inner monologues of all the so-called teeming millions of masses and classes alike jostled for space within my head. In the beginning, when I was content to be an audience, before I began to act, there was a language problem. The voices babbled in everything from Malayalam to Naga dialects, from the purity of Lucknow Urdu to the southern slurrings of Tamil. I understood only a fraction of the things being said within the walls of my skull. Only later, when I began to probe, did I learn that below the surface transmissions, the front of mind stuff, which is what I'd originally been picking up, language faded away and was replaced by universally intelligible thought forms, which far transcended words. But that was after I heard, beneath the polyglot frenzy in my head, those other precious signals, utterly different from everything else, most of them faint and distant, like far-off drums whose insistent pulsing eventually broke through the fish-market cacophony of my voices, those secret nocturnal calls, like calling out to, like, the unconscious beacons of the children of midnight, signalling nothing more than their existence, transmitting simply, I. From far to the north, I, and the south-east-west, I, and I. But I mustn't get ahead of myself. In the beginning, before I broke through to more than telepathy, I contented myself with listening. and soon I was able to tune my inner ear to those voices which I could understand. Nor was it long before I picked out from the throng the voices of my own family and of Mary Pereira and of friends, classmates, teachers. In the street, I learned how to identify the mind stream of passing strangers. The laws of Dopplership continued to operate in these paranormal realms, and the voices grew and diminished as the strangers passed. All of which I somehow kept to myself, reminded daily by the buzzing in my left or sinister ear of my father's wrath, and anxious to keep my right ear in good working order, I sealed my lips. For a 9-year-old boy, the difficulties of concealing knowledge are almost insurmountable, but fortunately, my nearest and dearest were as anxious to forget my outburst as I was to conceal the truth. "Oh, you, Salim, such things you talked yesterday. Shame on you, boy. You better go wash out your mouth with soap." The morning after my disgrace, Mary Pereira, shaking with indignation like one of her jellies, suggested the perfect means of my rehabilitation. Bowing my head contritely, I went, without a word, into the bathroom, and there, beneath the amazed gaze of Ayah and Monkey, scrubbed teeth, tongue, roof of mouth, gums with a toothbrush, covered in the sharp, foul lather of coal tar soap. The news of my dramatic atonement rushed rapidly around the house, borne by Mary and Monkey, and my mother embraced me. "There, good boy, we'll say no more about it." And Amit Sanai nodded gruffly at the breakfast table. "At least the boy has the grace to admit when he's gone too far." As my glass-inflicted cuts faded, it was as though my announcement was also erased, and by the time of my 9th birthday, nobody besides myself remembered anything about the day when I had taken the name of archangels in vain. The taste of detergent lingered on my tongue for many weeks, reminding me of the need for secrecy. Even the brass monkey was satisfied by my show of contrition. In her eyes, I had returned to form, and was once more the goody-two-shoes of the family. To demonstrate her willingness to re-establish the old order, she set fire to my mother's favourite slippers, and regained her rightful place in the family doghouse. Amongst outsiders, what's more, displaying a conservatism you'd never have suspected in such a tomboy, she closed ranks with my parents, and kept my one aberration a secret from her friends and mine. In a country where any physical or mental peculiarity in a child is a source of deep family shame, my parents, who had become accustomed to facial birthmarks, cucumber nose, and bandy legs, simply refused to see any more embarrassing things in me. For my part, I did not once mention the buzzings in my ear, the occasional ringing bells of deafness, the intermittent pain. I had learned that secrets were not always a bad thing. But imagine the confusion inside my head, where, behind the hideous face, above the tongue tasting of soap, hard by the perforated eardrum, lurked a not very tidy mind, as full of bric-a-brac as 9-year-old pockets. Imagine yourself inside me somehow, looking out through my eyes, hearing the noise, the voices, and now the obligation of not letting people know. The hardest part was acting surprised, such as when my mother said, "Hey, Salim, guess what? We're going for a picnic to the Aray Milk Colony." And I had to go, "Ooh, exciting," when I had known all along, because I had heard her unspoken inner voice. And on my birthday, seeing all the presents in the donors' minds before they were even unwrapped. And the treasure hunt, ruined because there, in my father's head, was the location of each clue, every prize. And much harder things, such as going to see my father in his ground floor office. Here we are. And the moment I'm in there, my head is full of God knows what rot, because he's thinking about his secretary, Alice or Fernanda, his latest Coca-Cola girl. He's undressing her slowly in his head, and it's in my head too. She's sitting stark naked on a cane-bottom chair and now getting up, crisscross marks all across her rump. That's my father thinking, my father. Now he's looking at me, all funny. "What's the matter, son? Don't you feel well?" "Yes, fine, Abba, fine. Must go now. Got to get away. Homework to do, Abba." "And out. Run away before he sees the clue on your face." My father always said that when I was lying, there was a red light flashing on my forehead. You see how hard it is? My Uncle Hanif comes to take me to the wrestling, and even before we've arrived at Vallabhbhai Patel Stadium on Hornby Velar, I'm feeling sad. We're walking with the crowds past giant cardboard cutouts of Dara Singh and Tagra Baba and the rest. And his sadness, my favourite uncle's sadness, is pouring into me. It lives like a lizard just beneath the hedge of his jollity, concealed by his booming laugh, which was once the laugh of the boatman Tai. We're sitting in excellent seats as floodlights dance on the backs of the interlocked wrestlers, and I'm caught in the unbreakable grip of my uncle's grief, the grief of his failing film career. Flop after flop, he'll probably never get a film again. But I mustn't let the sadness leak out of my eyes. He's butting into my thoughts. Hey, fail one. Hey, little wrestler. What's dragging your face down? It looks longer than a bad movie. You want chana? Pakoras? What? And me, shaking my head. No, nothing. Hanif Mamu, so that he relaxes, turns away, starts yelling, Oh, hey, come on, Dara. That's the ticket. Give him hell. Dara, yar. And back home, my mother's squatting in the corridor with the ice cream tub, saying with her real outside voice, You want to help me make it, son? Your favourite pistachio flavour? And I'm turning the handle. But her inside voice is bouncing against the inside of my head. I can see how she's trying to fill up every nook and cranny of her thoughts with everyday things. The price of pomfret, the roster of household chores, must call in the electrician to mend the ceiling fan in the dining room, how she's desperately concentrating on parts of her husband to love. But the unmentionable word keeps finding room, the two syllables which leaked out of her in the bathroom that day. Nadir, Nadir, Nah. She's finding it harder and harder to put down the telephone when the wrong numbers come. My mother. I tell you, when a boy gets inside grown-up thoughts, they can really mess him up completely. And even at night, no respite. I wake up at the stroke of midnight with Mary Pereira's dreams inside my head, night after night, always at my personal witching hour, which also has meaning for her. Her dreams are plagued by the image of a man who has been dead for years, Joseph da Costa. The dream tells me the name. It is coated with guilt. I cannot understand the same guilt which seeps into us all every time we eat our chutneys. There is a mystery here, but because the secret is not in the front of her mind, I can't find it out. And meanwhile, Joseph is there, each night, sometimes in human form, but not always. Sometimes he's a wolf or a snail, once a broomstick. But we, she, dreaming, I looking in, know it's him. Baleful, implacable, accusative, cursing her in the language of his incarnations, howling at her when he's Wolf Joseph, covering her in the slime trails of Joseph the Snail, beating her with the business end of his broomstick incarnation. And in the morning when she's telling me to bathe, clean up, get ready for school, I have to bite back the questions. I am 9 years old and lost in the confusion of other people's lives, which are blurring together in the heat. To end this account of the early days of my transformed life, I must add one painful confession. It occurred to me that I could improve my parents' opinion of me by using my new faculty to help out with my schoolwork. In short, I began to cheat in class. That is to say, I tuned into the inner voices of my school teachers and also of my cleverer classmates and picked information out of their minds. I found that very few of my masters could set a test without rehearsing the ideal answers in their minds. And I knew, too, that on those rare occasions when the teacher was preoccupied by other things, his private love life or financial difficulties, the solutions could always be found in the precocious, prodigious mind of our class genius Cyrus the Great. My marks began to improve dramatically, but not overly so, because I took care to make my versions different from their stolen originals, even when I telepathically cribbed an entire English essay from Cyrus, I added a number of mediocre touches of my own. My purpose was to avoid suspicion. I did not, but I escaped discovery. Under Emil Zagalo's furious, interrogating eyes, I remained innocently seraphic. Beneath the bemused, head-shaking perplexity of Mr. Tandon, the English master, I worked my treachery in silence, knowing that they would not believe the truth even if, By chance or folly, I spilled the beans. Let me sum up. At a crucial point in the history of our child nation, at a time when five-year plans were being drawn up and elections were approaching and language marches were fighting over Bombay, a nine-year-old boy named Salim Sanai acquired a miraculous gift. Despite the many vital uses to which his abilities could have been put by his impoverished, underdeveloped country, he chose to conceal his talents, frittering them away of inconsequential voyeurism and petty cheating. This behaviour, not, I confess, the behaviour of a hero, was the direct result of a confusion in his mind which invariably muddled up morality. The desire to do what is right and popularity, the rather more dubious desire to do what is approved of. Fearing parental ostracism, he suppressed the news of his transformation. Seeking parental congratulations, he abused his talents at school. This flaw in his character can partially be excused on the grounds of his tender years, but only partially. Confused thinking was to bedevil much of his career. I can be quite tough in my self-judgments when I choose. What stood on the flat roof of the Breach Candy Kindergarten? A roof, you will recall, which could be reached from the garden of Buckingham Villa simply by climbing over a boundary wall. What no longer capable of performing the function for which it was designed, watched over us that year, when even the winter forgot to cool down? What observed Sunny Ibrahim, Ice Slice Hair Oil and myself as we played kabaddi and French cricket and seven tiles with the occasional participation of Cyrus the Great and of other visiting friends, Fat Purse Fishwaller and Glandy Keith Colico? What was present on the frequent occasions when Toxie Catrack's nurse, Bye Up, yelled down from the top floor of Homie's home, "Brats, rackety good-for-nothing, shut your noise!" so that we all ran away, returning, when she vanished from our sight, to make mute faces at the window at which she'd stood. In short, what was it, tall and blue and flaking, which oversaw our lives, which seemed for a while to be marking time, waiting not only for the nearby time when we would put on long trousers, but also, perhaps, for the coming of Evie Burns? Perhaps you'd like clues. What had once hidden bombs? In what had Joseph da Costa died of snakebite? When, after some months of inner torment, I at last sought refuge from grown-up voices, I found it in an old clock tower, which nobody bothered to lock. And here, in the solitude of rusting time, I paradoxically took my first tentative steps towards that involvement with mighty events and public lives from which I would never again be free. Never! Until the widow... Banned from washing chests, I began, whenever possible, to creep unobserved into the tower of crippled hours. When the circus ring was emptied by heat or chance or prying eyes, when Ahmed and Amina went off to the Willingdon Club for canasta evenings, when the brass monkey was away, hanging around her newly acquired heroines, the Walsingham School for Girls swimming and diving team, that is to say, when circumstances permitted, I entered my secret hideout, stretched out on the straw mat I'd stolen from the servants' quarters, closed my eyes, and let my newly awakened inner ear, connected like all ears to my nose, rove freely around the city, and further north and south, east and west, listening in to all manner of things. To escape the intolerable pressures of eavesdropping on people I knew, I practiced my art upon strangers. Thus my entry into public affairs of India occurred for entirely ignoble reasons. Upset by too much intimacy, I used the world outside our hillock for light relief. The world as discovered from a broken-down clock tower. At first, I was no more than a tourist, a child peeping through the miraculous peepholes of a private dilly-deco machine. Dug-duggee drums rattled in my left damaged ear as I gained my first glimpse of the Taj Mahal through the eyes of a fat Englishwoman suffering from the tummy runs, after which, to balance south against north, I hopped down to Madurai's Meenakshi Temple and nestled amongst the woolly, mystical perceptions of a chanting priest. I toured Connaught Place in New Delhi in the guise of an auto rickshaw driver, complaining bitterly to my fares about the rising price of gasoline. In Calcutta, I slept rough in a section of drainpipe. By now, thoroughly bitten by the travel bug, I zipped down to Cape Comorin and became a fisherwoman whose sari was as tight as her morals were loose. Standing on red sands washed by three seas, I flirted with Dravidian beachcombers in a language I couldn't understand. Then up into the Himalayas, into the Neanderthal moss-covered hut of a Gujar tribal, beneath the glory of a completely circular rainbow and the tumbling moraine of the Kolahoy Glacier. At the golden fortress of Jaisalmer, I sampled the inner life of a woman making mirror-work dresses, and at Kajuharu, I was an adolescent village boy, deeply embarrassed by the erotic tantric carvings on the Chandela temples standing in the fields, but unable to tear away my eyes. In the exotic simplicities of travel, I was able to find a modicum of peace. But, in the end, tourism ceased to satisfy. Curiosity began to niggle. "Let's find out," I told myself, "what really goes on around here." With the eclectic spirit of my 9 years spurring me on, I leapt into the heads of film stars and cricketers. I learned the truth behind the filmfare gossip about the dancer Vijayantimala, and I was at the crease with Polly Umrigar at the Brabourne Stadium. I was Lata Mangeshkar, the playback singer, and Boo-Boo the Clown at the circus behind Civil Lines. And inevitably, through the random processes of my mind-hopping, I discovered politics. At one time, I was a landlord in Uttar Pradesh, my belly roiling over my pyjama cord as I ordered serfs to set my surplus grain on fire. At another moment, I was starving to death in Orissa, where there was a food shortage as usual. I was 2 months old, and my mother had run out of breast milk. I occupied briefly the mind of a Congress Party worker, bribing a village schoolteacher to throw his weight behind the party of Gandhi and Nehru in the coming election campaign. Also, the thoughts of a Keralan peasant who had decided to vote communist. My daring grew. One afternoon, I deliberately invaded the head of our own state chief minister, which was how I discovered over 20 years before it became a national joke that Morarji Desai took his own water daily. I was inside him, tasting the warmth as he gurgled down a frothing glass of urine. And finally, I hit my highest point. I became Jawaharlal Nehru, Prime Minister and author of Framed Letters. I sat with the great man amongst a bunch of gap-toothed, straggle-beard astrologers and adjusted the 5-year plan to bring it into harmonic alignment with the music of the spheres. The high life is a heady thing. "Look at me," I exulted silently. "I can go any place I want." In that tower, which had once been filled chock-a-block with the explosive devices of Joseph da Costa's hatred, this phrase, accompanied by appropriate tick-tock sound effects, plopped, fully formed, into my thoughts. "I am the tomb in Bombay. Watch me explode." Because the feeling had come upon me that I was somehow creating a world, that the thoughts I jumped inside were mine, that the bodies I occupied acted at my command, that as current affairs, arts, sports, the whole rich variety of a first-class radio station poured into me, I was somehow making them happen. Which is to say, I had entered into the illusion of the artist and thought of the multitudinous realities of the land as the raw, unshaped material of my gift. "I can find out any damn thing," I triumphed. "There isn't a thing I cannot know." Today, with the hindsight of the lost spent years, I can say that the spirit of self-aggrandizement which seized me then was a reflex born of an instinct for self-preservation. If I had not believed myself in control of the flooding multitudes, their massed identities would have annihilated mine. But there, in my clock tower, filled with the cockiness of my glee, I became sin, the ancient moon god. No, not Indian. I've imported him from Hadramut of old, capable of acting at a distance and shifting the tides of the world. But death, when it visited Methil's estate, still managed to take me by surprise. Even though the freezing of his assets had ended many years ago, the zone below Ahmed Sinai's waist had remained as cold as ice. Ever since the day he had cried out, "The bastards are shoving my balls in an ice bucket," and Amina had taken them in her hands to warm them so that her fingers got glued to them by the cold, his sex had lain dormant, a woolly elephant in an iceberg, like the one they found in Russia in 56. My mother, Amina, who had married for children, felt the uncreated lives rotting in her womb and blamed herself for becoming unattractive to him, what with her corns and all. She discussed her unhappiness with Mary Pereira, but the ayah only told her that there was no happiness to be gained from the men's. They made pickles together as they talked, and Amina stirred her disappointments into a hot lime chutney, which never failed to bring tears to the eyes. Although Ahmed Sinai's office hours were filled with fantasies of secretaries taking dictation in the nude, visions of his Fernandas or poppies strolling around the room in their birthday suits with crisscross cane marks on their rumps, his apparatus refused to respond. And one day, when the real Fernanda or poppy had gone home, he was playing chess with Dr. Nalika, his tongue as well as his game made somewhat loose by gins, and he confided awkwardly, "Nalika, I seem to have lost interest in you-know-what." A gleam of pleasure radiated from the luminous gynecologist. The birth control fanatic in the dark glowing doctor leapt out through his eyes and made the following speech. "Bravo!" Dr. Nalika cried. "Brother Sinai, damn good show. You, and may I add myself, yes, you and I, Sinai Bhai, are persons of rare spiritual worth. Not for us the panting humiliations of the flesh. Is it not a finer thing, I ask you, to eschew procreation, to avoid adding one more miserable human life to the vast multitudes which are presently beggaring our country, and instead to bend our energies to the task of giving them more land to stand on? I tell you, my friend, you and I and our tetrapods, from the very oceans we shall bring forth soil." To consecrate this oration, Ahmed Sinai poured drinks. My father and Dr. Nalika drank a toast to their four-legged concrete dream. "Land, yes. Love, no," Dr. Nalika said a little unsteadily. My father refilled his glass. By the last days of 1956, the dream of reclaiming land from the sea with the aid of thousands upon thousands of large concrete tetrapods, that same dream which had been the cause of the freeze and which was now for my father a sort of surrogate for the sexual activity which the aftermath of the freeze denied him, actually seemed to be coming close to fruition. This time, however, Ahmed Sinai was spending his money cautiously. This time he remained hidden in the background and his name appeared on no documents. This time he had learned the lessons of the freeze and was determined to draw as little attention to himself as possible, so that when Dr. Nalika betrayed him by dying, leaving behind him no record of my father's involvement in the tetrapod scheme, Ahmed Sinai, who was prone, as we have seen, to react badly in the face of disaster, was swallowed up by the mouth of a long, snaking decline, from which he would not emerge until, at the very end of his days, he at last fell in love with his wife. This is the story that got back to Methil's estate. Dr. Nalika had been visiting friends near Marine Drive. At the end of the visit, he had resolved to stroll down to Chowpatty Beach and buy himself some bel puri and a little coconut milk. As he strolled briskly along the pavement by the sea wall, he overtook the tail end of a language march, which moved slowly along, chanting peacefully. Dr. Nalika neared the place where, with the municipal corporation's permission, he had arranged for a single symbolic tetrapod to be placed upon the sea wall, as a kind of icon pointing the way to the future. And here he noticed a thing which made him lose his reason. A group of beggar women had clustered around the tetrapod and were performing the rite of puja. They had lighted oil lamps at the base of the object. One of them had painted the Om symbol on its upraised tip. They were chanting prayers as they gave the tetrapod a thorough and worshipful wash. Technological miracle had been transformed into Shiva Lingam. Dr. Nalika, the opponent of fertility, was driven wild at this vision, in which it seemed to him that all the old dark priapic forces of ancient procreative India had been unleashed upon the beauty of sterile 20th century concrete. Sprinting along, he shouted his abuse at the worshipping women. Gleaming fiercely in his rage, reaching them, he kicked away their little dia lamps. It is said he even tried to push the women. And he was seen by the eyes of the language marchers. The ears of the language marchers heard the roughness of his tongue. The marchers' feet paused, their voices rose in rebuke, fists were shaken, oaths were oathed, whereupon the good doctor, made incautious by anger, turned upon the crowd and denigrated its cause, its breeding and its sisters. A silence fell and exerted its powers. Silence guided marcher feet towards the gleaming gynecologist, who stood between the tetrapod and the wailing women. In silence, the marcher's hands reached out towards Nalika, and in a deep hush he clung to four-legged concrete as they attempted to pull him towards them. In absolute soundlessness, fear gave Dr. Nalika the strength of limpets. His arms stuck to the tetrapod and would not be detached. The marchers applied themselves to the tetrapod. Silently, they began to rock it. Mutely, the force of their numbers overcame its weight. In an evening seized by demonic quietness, the tetrapod tilted, preparing to become the first of its kind to enter the waters and begin the great work of land reclamation. Dr. Suresh Nalika, his mouth opening in a voiceless A, clung to it like a phosphorescent mollusk. Man and four-legged concrete fell without a sound. The splash of the waters broke the spell. It was said that when Dr. Nalika fell and was crushed into death by the weight of his beloved obsession, nobody had any trouble locating the body, because it sent light glowing upwards through the waters like a fire.
"Do you know what's happening? Hey, man, what gives?"
Children, myself included, clustered around the garden hedge of Escorial Villa, in which Dr. Nalika's bachelor apartment and a hamal of Leela Sabarmati's, taking on an air of grave dignity, informed us. They have brought his death home wrapped in silk. I was not allowed to see the death of Dr. Nalika as it lay wreathed in saffron flowers on his hard, single bed, but I got to know all about it anyway, because the news of it spread far beyond the confines of his room. Mostly I heard about it from the estate servants, who found it quite natural to speak openly of a death, but rarely said much about life, because in life everything was obvious. From Dr. Nalika's own bearer, I learned that the death had, by swallowing large quantities of the sea, taken on the qualities of water. It had become a fluid thing, and looked happy, sad, or indifferent, according to how the light hit it. Homi Katrak's gardener interjected,
"It is dangerous to look too long at death. Otherwise, you come away with a little of it inside you, and there are effects."
We asked, "Effects? What effects? Which effects? How?" And Purushottam the sadhu, who had left his place under the Buckingham Villa garden tap for the first time in years, said,
"Death makes the living see themselves too clearly. After they have been in its presence, they become exaggerated."
This extraordinary claim was, in fact, borne out by events, because afterwards Toxie Katrak's nurse, Bayarp, who had helped to clean up the body, became shriller, more shrewish, more terrifying than ever, and it seemed that everyone who saw the death of Dr. Nalika as it lay in state was affected. Nussi Ibrahim became even sillier and more of a duck, and Leela Savarmati, who lived upstairs from the death and had helped to arrange its room, afterwards gave in to a promiscuity which had always been lurking within her, and set herself on a road at whose end there would be bullets, and her husband, Commander Sabarmati, conducting the Kolaba traffic with a most unusual baton. Our family, however, stayed away from the death. My father refused to go and pay his respects, and would never refer to his late friend by name, calling him simply "that traitor." 2 days later, when the news had been in the papers, Dr. Nalika suddenly acquired an enormous family of female relations. Having been a bachelor and misogynist all his life, he was engulfed in death by a sea of giant, noisy, omnicompetent women who came crawling out from strange corners of the city, from milking jobs at Umul Dairies, and from box offices of cinemas, from street-side soda fountains and unhappy marriages. In a year of processions, the Nalika women formed their own parade, an enormous stream of outsized womanhood flowing up our two-story hillock to fill Dr. Nalika's apartment so full that from the road below you could see their elbows sticking out of the windows and their behinds overflowing onto the veranda. For a week nobody got any sleep because the wailing of the Nalika women filled the air. But beneath their howls, the women were proving as competent as they looked. They took over the running of the nursing home. They investigated all of Nalika's business deals. And they cut my father out of the tetrapod deal just as coolly as you please. After all those years, my father was left with nothing but a hole in his pocket, while the women took Nalika's body to Benares to have it cremated. And the estate servants whispered to me that they had heard how the doctor's ashes were sprinkled on the waters of Holy Ganga at Manikarnika Ghat at dusk, and they did not sink, but floated on the surface of the water like tiny glowing firebugs, and were washed out to sea, where their strange luminosity must have frightened the captains of ships. As for Amit Sanai, I swear that it was after Nalika's death and the arrival of the women that he began literally to fade. Gradually his skin paled, his hair lost its colour, until within a few months he had become entirely white, except for the darkness of his eyes. Mary Pereira told Amina, "That man is cold in the blood, so now his skin is made ice, white ice like a fridge." I should say, in all honesty, that although he pretended to be worried by his transformation into a white man, and went to see doctors and so forth, he was secretly rather pleased when they failed to explain the problem or prescribe a cure, because he had long envied Europeans their pigmentation. One day, when it was permissible to make jokes again, a decent interval had been allowed to elapse after Dr. Nalika's death, he told Leela Sabarmati at the cocktail hour, "All the best people are white under the skin. I have merely given up pretending." His neighbours, all of whom were darker than he, laughed politely and felt curiously ashamed. Circumstantial evidence indicates that the shock of Nalika's death was responsible for giving me a snow-white father to set beside my ebony mother. But, although I don't know how much you're prepared to swallow, I shall risk giving an alternative explanation. A theory developed in the abstract privacy of my clock tower. Because during my frequent psychic travels, I discovered something rather odd. During the first 9 years after independence, a similar pigmentation disorder, whose first recorded victim may well have been the Rani of Kuchnaheel, afflicted large numbers of the nation's business community. All over India, I stumbled across good Indian businessmen, their fortunes thriving thanks to the first 5-year plan, which had concentrated on building up commerce. Businessmen who had become, or were becoming, very, very pale indeed. It seems that the gargantuan, even heroic, efforts involved in taking over from the British and becoming masters of their own destinies had drained the colour from their cheeks. In which case, perhaps my father was a late victim of a widespread, though generally unremarked, phenomenon. The businessmen of India were turning white. That's enough to chew on for one day. But Evelyn Lilith Burns is coming. The Pioneer Café is getting painfully close, and more vitally. Midnight's other children, including my alter ego Shiva, he of the deadly knees, are pressing extremely hard. Soon the cracks will be wide enough for them to escape. By the way, sometime around the end of 1956, in all probability, the singer and cuckold Wee Willie Winkie also met his death. Love in Bombay. During Ramzan, the month of fasting, we went to the movies as often as we could. After being shaken awake at 5 a.m. by my mother's assiduous hand, after pre-dawn breakfasts of melon and sugared lime water, and especially on Sunday mornings, the brass monkey and I took it in turns, or sometimes called out in unison, to remind Amina, "The 10:30 in the morning show! It's Metro Cup Club day, Anna, please!" Then the drive in the Rover to the cinema, where we would taste neither Coca-Cola nor potato crisps, neither quality ice cream nor samosas in greasy paper. But at least there was air conditioning and Cub Club badges pinned to our clothes and competitions and birthday announcements made by a compere with an inadequate moustache. And finally, the film. After the trailers with their introductory titles, next attraction and coming soon, and the cartoon. In a moment, the big film, but first, Quentin Durward, perhaps. Or Scaramouche. Swashbuckling, we'd say to one another afterwards, playing movie critic. And a rambunctious bawdy romp. Although we were ignorant of swashbuckles and bawdiness. There was not much praying in our family, except on Eid ul-Fitr, when my father took me to the Friday mosque to celebrate the holiday, by tying a handkerchief around my head and pressing my forehead to the ground. But we were always willing to fast, because we liked the cinema. Evie Burns and I agreed. The world's greatest movie star was Robert Taylor. I also liked Jay Silverheels as Tonto, but his chemo sabe, Clayton Moore, was too fat for the Lone Ranger in my view. Evelyn Lilith Burns arrived on New Year's Day 1957 to take up residence with her widower father in an apartment in one of the two squat, ugly concrete blocks which had grown up almost without our noticing them on the lower reaches of our hillock, and which were oddly segregated. Americans and other foreigners lived, like Evie, in Newville. Aravist Indian success stories ended up in Lakshmi Villas. From the heights of Methil's estate, we looked down on them all, on white and brown alike, but nobody ever looked down on Evie Burns, except once. Only once did anyone get on top of her. Before I climbed into my first pair of long pants, I fell in love with Evie. But love was a curious chain-reactive thing that year. To save time, I shall place all of us in the same row at the Metro Cinema. Robert Taylor is mirrored in our eyes as we sit in flickering trances, and also in symbolic sequence. Salim Sanai is sitting next to and in love with Evie Burns, who is sitting next to and in love with Sonny Ibrahim, who is sitting next to and in love with the Brass Monkey, who is sitting next to the aisle and feeling starving hungry. I loved Evie for perhaps 6 months of my life. 2 years later, she was back in America, knifing an old woman and being sent to reform school. A brief expression of my gratitude is in order at this point. If Evie had not come to live amongst us, my story might never have progressed beyond tourism in a clock tower and cheating in class. And then there would have been no climax in a widow's hostel, no clear proof of my meaning, no coda in a fuming factory over which there presides the winking saffron and green dancing figure of the neon goddess Mumba Devi. But Evie Burns, was she snake or ladder? The answer's obvious. Both. Did come complete with the silver bicycle, which enabled me not only to discover the Midnight Children, but also to ensure the partition of the state of Bombay. To begin at the beginning, her hair was made of scarecrow straw, her skin was peppered with freckles, and her teeth lived in a metal cage. These teeth were, it seemed, the only things on earth over which she was powerless. They grew wild in malicious, crazy paving overlaps and stung her dreadfully when she ate ice cream. I permit myself this one generalization. Americans have mastered the universe but have no dominion over their mouths, whereas India is impotent, but her children tend to have excellent teeth. Racked by toothaches, my Evie rose magnificently above the pain. Refusing to be ruled by bone and gums, she ate cake and drank Coke whenever they were going, and never complained. A tough kid, Evie Burns. Her conquest of suffering confirmed her sovereignty over us all. It has been observed that all Americans need a frontier. Pain was hers, and she was determined to push it out. Once, I shyly gave her a necklace of flowers, Queen of the Night for my Lily of the Eve, bought with my own pocket money from a hawker woman at Scandal Point. "I don't wear flowers," Evelyn Lilith said, and tossed the unwanted chain into the air. spearing it before it fell with a pellet from her unerring daisy air pistol, destroying flowers with a daisy. She served notice that she was not to be manacled, not even by a necklace. She was our capricious whirligig, Lil of the Hill, and also Eve, the Adam's apple of my eye. How she arrived. Sonny Ibrahim, I Slice and Heros Abamati, Cyrus Dubash, the monkey, and I were playing French cricket in the circus ring between Methil's four palaces. A New Year's Day game. Toxie, clapping at her barred window, even Biapa was in good humour and not for once abusing us. Cricket, even French cricket, and even when played by children, is a quiet game. Peace anointed in linseed oil. The kissing of leather and willow. Sprinkled applause, the occasional cry. Shot! Shot, sir! How's that? But Evie on her bicycle was having none of that. Hey, you! Allah, you! Hey, what's the matter? You all deaf or what? I was batting, elegantly as Ranji, powerfully as Vinu Mankad, when she charged up the hill on her two-wheeler, straw hair flying, freckles ablaze, mouth metal flashing semaphore messages in the sunlight. A scarecrow astride a silver bullet. Hey, you! With a leaky nose. Stop watching that scoopid bald yakram. I'll show you something worth watching. Impossible to picture Evie Burns without also conjuring up a bicycle. And not just any two-wheeler, but one of the last of the great old-timers, an Arjuna India bike in mint condition, with drop handlebars wrapped in masking tape and five gears and a seat made of resin cheetah skin. And a silver frame, the colour, I don't need to tell you, of the Lone Ranger's horse. Slobby Eye Slice and Neat Hair Oil, Cyrus the Genius and the Monkey and Sonny Ibrahim and myself, the best of friends, the true sons of the estate, its heirs by right of birth. Sonny, with the slow innocence he had had ever since the forceps dented his brain, and me, with my dangerous secret knowledge, yes, all of us, future bullfighters and navy chiefs and all, stood frozen in open-mouth attitudes as Evie Burns began to ride her bike faster, 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 around and around the edges of the circus ring. "Look at me now! Watch me go, you dummies!" On and off the cheetah seat, Evie performed. One foot on the seat, one leg stretched out behind her. She whirled around us. She built up speed and then did a headstand on the seat. She could straddle the front wheel facing the rear and work the pedals the wrong way round. Gravity was her slave, speed her element, and we knew that a power had come among us. A witch on wheels, and the flowers of the hedgerows threw her petals. The dust of the circus ring stood up in clouds of ovation, because the circus ring had found its mistress too. It was the canvas beneath the brush of her whirling wheels. Now we noticed that our heroine packed a daisy air pistol on her right hip. "Mata, come, ye zeros!" she yelled, and drew the weapon. Her pellets gave stones the gift of flight. We threw annas into the air, and she gunned them down, stone dead. "Targets! More targets!" And Eyeslice surrendered his beloved pack of rummy cards without a murmur, so that she could shoot the heads off the kings. Annie Oakley in tooth braces. Nobody dared question her sharp shooting, except once, and that was the end of her reign, during the great cat invasion. And there were extenuating circumstances. Flushed, sweating, Evie Burns dismounted and announced, "From now on, there's a new big chief around here. Okay, Indians? Any arguments?" No arguments. I knew then that I had fallen in love. At Juhu Beach with Evie, she won the camel races, could drink more coconut milk than any of us, could open her eyes under the sharp salt water of the Arabian Sea. Did 6 months make such a difference? Evie was half a year older than me. Did it entitle you to talk to grown-ups as an equal? Evie was seen gossiping with old man Ibrahim Ibrahim. She claimed Leela Sabarmati was teaching her to put on makeup. She visited Homi Katrak to gossip about guns. It was the tragic irony of Homi Katrak's life that he, at whom a gun would one day be pointed, was a true aficionado of firearms. In Evie, he found a fellow creature, a motherless child who was, unlike his own Toxie, as sharp as a knife and as bright as a bottle. Incidentally, Evie Burns wasted no sympathy on poor Toxie Katrak. "Wrong in her head," she opined carelessly to us all. "Ought to be put down like rats." But Evie, rats are not weak. There was more that was rodent-like in your face than in the whole body of your despised tox. That was Evelyn Lilith, and within weeks of her arrival, I had set off the chain reaction from whose effects I would never fully recover. It began with Sonny Ibrahim, Sonny next door, Sonny of the Forcep Hollows, who has been sitting patiently in the wings of my story, awaiting his cue. In those days, Sonny was a badly bruised fellow. More than forceps had dented him. To love the brass monkey, even in the nine-year-old sense of the word, was no easy thing to do. As I've said, my sister, born second and unheralded, had begun to react violently to any declarations of affection. Although she was believed to speak the languages of birds and cats, the soft words of lovers roused in her an almost animal rage. But Sonny was too simple to be warned off. For months now, he had been pestering her with statements such as, "Salim, sister, you're a pretty solid type," or, "Listen, you want to be my girl? We could go to the pictures with your ayah, maybe." And for an equal number of months, she had been making him suffer for his love, telling tales to his mother, pushing him into mud puddles, accidentally, on purpose. Once even assaulting him physically, leaving him with long raking claw marks down his face and an expression of sad dog injury in his eyes. But he would not learn. And so at last, she had planned her most terrible revenge. The monkey attended Walsingham School for Girls on Nepean Sea Road, a school full of tall, superbly muscled Europeans who swam like fish and dived like submarines. In their spare time, they could be seen from our bedroom window, cavorting in the map-shaped pool of the Breach Candy Club, from which we were, of course, barred. And when I discovered that the monkey had somehow attached herself to these segregated swimmers as a sort of mascot, I felt genuinely aggrieved with her for, perhaps, the first time. But there was no arguing with her. She went her own way. Beefy 15-year-old white girls let her sit with them on the Walsingham school bus. Three such females would wait with her every morning at the same place where Sonny, Eye Slice, Hera, Cyrus the Great, and I awaited the bus from the cathedral school. One morning, for some forgotten reason, Sonny and I were the only boys at the stop. Maybe there was a bug going round or something. The monkey waited until Mary Pereira had left us alone in the care of the beefy swimmers. And then, suddenly, the truth of what she was planning flashed into my head, as, for no particular reason, I tuned into her thoughts. And I yelled, "Hey!" But too late. The monkey screeched, "You keep out of this!" And then she and the three beefy swimmers had jumped upon Sonny Ibrahim. Street sleepers and beggars and bicycling clerks were watching with open amusement, because they were ripping every scrap of clothing off his body. "Damn it, man, are you just going to stand and watch?" Sonny yelling for help. But I was immobilised. How could I take sides between my sister and my best friend and he? "I'll tell my daddy on you!" Tearful now, while the monkey, "That'll teach you to talk shit, and that'll teach you!" His shoes off, no shirt anymore, his vest dragged off by a high-board diver. "And that'll teach you to write your sissy love letters!" No socks now, and plenty of tears, and "There!" yelled the monkey. The Walsingham bus arrived, and the assailants and my sister jumped in and sped away. "Ta-ta, bata, lover boy," they yelled, and Sonny was left in the street on the pavement opposite Chimalka's and Reader's Paradise, naked as the day he was born. His forcep hollows glistened like rock pools, because Vaseline had dripped into them from his hair, and his eyes were wet as well as he. "Why she do it, man? Why, when I only told her I liked..." "Search me," I said, not knowing where to look. "She does things, that's all." Not knowing either that the time would come when she did something worse to me. But that was 9 years later. Meanwhile, early in 1957, election campaigns had begun. The Jansang was campaigning for rest homes for aged sacred cows. In Kerala, E.M.S. Nambudiripad was promising that communism would give everyone food and jobs. In Madras, the Anna DMK party of C.N. Annadurai fanned the flames of regionalism. The Congress fought back with reforms such as the Hindu Succession Act, which gave Hindu women equal rights of inheritance. In short, everybody was busy pleading his own cause. I, however, found myself tongue-tied in the face of Evie Burns and approached Sonny Ibrahim to ask him to plead on my behalf. In India, we've always been vulnerable to Europeans. Evie had only been with us a matter of weeks, and already I was being sucked into a grotesque mimicry of European literature. We had done Cyrano in a simplified version at school. I had also read the Classics Illustrated comic book. Perhaps it would be fair to say that Europe repeats itself in India as farce. Evie was American. Same thing.
But hey, man, that's no fair, man. Why don't you do it yourself?
Listen, Sonny, I pleaded, you're my friend, right?
Yeah, but you didn't even help.
That was my sister, Sonny, so how could I?
No, so you have to do your own dirty...
Hey, Sonny, man, think only. These girls need careful handling, man. Look how the monkey flies off the handle. You've got the experience, yeah? You've been through it. You'll know how to go gently this time. What do I know, man? Maybe she doesn't like me, even. You want me to have my clothes torn off, too? That would make you feel better? And innocent, good-natured Sonny. Well, no. Okay, then. You go. Sing my praises a little. Say, never mind about my nose. Character is what counts. You can do that.
Well, I... Okay. But you talk to your sis also, yeah?
I'll talk, Sonny. What can I promise? You know what she's like. But I'll talk to her for sure. You can lay your strategies as carefully as you like, but women will undo them at a stroke. For every victorious election campaign, there are twice as many that fail. From the veranda of Buckingham Villa, through the slats of the chick blind, I spied on Sonny Ibrahim as he canvassed my chosen constituency, and heard the voice of the electorate, the rising nasality of Evie Byrne splitting the air with scorn.
Who, him? Why ain't you tell him just to go blow his nose? That sniffer, he can't even ride a bike!
Which was true. And there was worse to come. Because now, although a chick blind divided the scene into narrow slits, did I not see the expression on Evie's face begin to soften and change? Did Evie's hand, sliced lengthways by the chick, not reach out towards my electoral agent? And weren't those Evie's fingers, the nails bitten down to the quick, touching Sonny's temple hollows, the fingertips getting covered in dribbled Vaseline? And did Evie say, or did she not, "Now, you, for instance, you're cute"? Let me sadly affirm that I did. It did. They were. She did. Salim Sanai loves Evie Burns. Evie loves Sonny Ibrahim. Sonny is potty about the brass monkey. But what does the monkey say?
Don't make me sick, Allah, my sister said when I tried rather nobly, considering how he'd failed me, to argue Sonny's case.
The voters had given the thumbs down to us both. I wasn't giving in just yet. The siren temptations of Evie Burns, who never cared about me, I'm bound to admit, led me inexorably towards my fall. But I hold nothing against her, because my fall led to a rise. Privately in my clock tower, I took time off my trans-subcontinental rambles to consider the wooing of my freckled Eve. Forget middlemen, I advised myself. You'll have to do this personally. Finally, I formed my scheme. I would have to share her interests to make her passions mine. Guns have never appealed to me. I resolved to learn how to ride a bike. Evie, in those days, had given in to the many demands of the hillock-top children that she teach them her bicycle arts. So it was a simple matter for me to join the queue for lessons. We assembled in the circus ring. Evie, ringmistress supreme, stood in the centre of five wobbly, furiously concentrating cyclists, while I stood beside her, bikeless. Until Evie's coming, I'd shown no interest in wheels, so I'd never been given any. Humbly, I suffered the lash of Evie's tongue.
"Where have you been living, fatnose? I suppose you want to borrow mine?"
"No," I lied penitently, and she relented. "Okay, okay." Evie shrugged. "Get in the saddle and let's see what you're made of." Let me reveal at once that